Ever feel like deciphering patent law, especially when multiple companies are involved, requires cracking some ancient code? You're definitely not alone. It can get incredibly complex, incredibly fast.
Oh, absolutely.
But today, we're tackling a case that actually throws a much-needed lifeline into these murky waters. Travel Century v. Trop.
And what's particularly interesting about this case, beyond the specifics of luggage locks, is how it illuminates the broader challenges of patent infringement in our increasingly collaborative world.
Yeah.
It really makes you think about who's responsible when, well, when a patented invention or process involves more than one player.
Exactly. So the core of this case revolves around dual access luggage locks, those handy locks that allow both you and the TSA to open your suitcase without damage.
Right, those ones you see everywhere now.
Yeah. A fellow named David Trop held a couple of patents, the 537 and 728 patents, covering this very idea. Then you have Travel Century, a company with its own competing lock system. Crucially, Travel Century had a memorandum of understanding and MOU with the TSA.
Ah, the MOU. Think of an MOU as, well, basically a formal agreement outlining their cooperative relationship.
Right.
And that MOU, that agreement between Travel Century and the TSA, is really where the central legal questions in this case begin to surface. It defines how these two entities interact with the technology at the heart of the patents.
Precisely. And it leads us to the million-dollar question. When can a company like Travel Century be held liable for patent infringement, even if another entity, the TSA in this instance, is the one physically carrying out some of the steps of the patented invention?
That's the crux of it.
This is the realm of divided infringement under 35 U.S.C. Section 271A. That's the part of patent law that lays out what constitutes infringement and the framework established by the Akamai case.
Yeah, Akamai is key here.
What Travel Century v. Trop does so well is give us a real-world example of how this framework is applied, which is, incredibly valuable for understanding patent law in today's landscape of shared responsibilities.
It really raises a fundamental question for anyone interested in patent law. How do you determine infringement when the actions that constitute the patented invention are spread across multiple independent parties? That's the puzzle this case helps us solve.
So our mission in this deep dive is to dissect the legal intricacies of this case. We're going to unpack the Federal Circuit's key reasoning and extract the practical lessons for understanding patent infringement when you have multiple actors involved.
Sounds good. Where should we start?
Okay, so let's start with the basics. Direct infringement. Generally speaking, under 35 U.S.C. Section 271A, for direct infringement to occur, a single entity usually needs to perform every single step of a patented method. Think of it like baking a cake. One person follows all the steps in the recipe.
That's the traditional view, yeah. If a patent describes a specific sequence of actions to achieve a result, typically one company would have to perform each and every one of those actions to be found directly infringing the patent. It's a complete performance by a single actor.
But what happens when that cake recipe involves actions from multiple people? Say, one person provides the ingredients, another mixes them, and a third bakes it.
Right.
In the world of patents, especially with complex technologies and services, it's rarely that straightforward. How do you pinpoint the infringer then?
Exactly. And that's the challenge the courts have grappled with as technology and business models have evolved to involve more distributed processes. How do you apply that traditional concept of direct infringement when the patented method inherently requires the participation of multiple parties?
And that's where Akamai steps in.
This is where the Akamai test comes into play. It's a framework designed specifically to address these multi-actor scenarios.
Right. The Akamai framework provides a two-pronged approach to determine when the actions of multiple parties can be attributed to a single entity for the purpose of establishing direct infringement.
What's fascinating here is that Akamai offers two distinct paths to potentially establish this liability when the steps of a patented invention are carried out by different actors. It's not just one way to look at it.
That's right. The first path is direction or control. Can you elaborate on what exactly direction or control means in this legal context? Like, what kind of influence needs to be present?
Certainly. Direction or control, as interpreted by the courts, goes beyond simply giving instructions or, providing tools. It involves actively conditioning someone's participation in an activity or the receipt of a benefit on them performing specific steps of the patented method.
Okay, conditioning participation.
Right. And it also includes dictating the precise manner or the exact timing of that performance. Think of it less like a suggestion and more like, well, a requirement tied to an advantage or a benefit.
So it's not just saying, hey, it would be great if you did this. It's more like, if you want to participate in the system or receive this benefit, you must do it this particular way and maybe even at this particular time.
Precisely. That's the core of the direction or control idea. The other prong of the Akamai test is joint enterprise. Now, while the travel-centric court's primary analysis focuses on direction or control, it's useful to briefly understand this other path.
Okay, joint enterprise.
A joint enterprise involves two or more entities acting together with both mutual agency, meaning each kind of acts on behalf of the other, and shared goals in the performance of the patented method. Think of maybe a business partnership where each partner takes specific actions that together infringe a patent.
Got it. So two main ways Akamai looks at it, direction control or joint enterprise.
Exactly. But direction control is really the focus in Travel Sentry.
Okay, so with that legal framework in our minds, let's get into the nitty-gritty of Travel Sentry v. TROP. Remind us about the specifics of TROP's patented method for these dual-access luggage locks.
Sure. TROP's patents covered a method for the secure inspection of airline luggage. The key innovation was a type of lock that could be opened not only by the luggage owner using, say, a personal key or combination, but also by authorized security personnel, like the TSA, using a set of master keys.
Right, the master keys.
This allowed for efficient security screening without the need to physically break open locked luggage, which was a big problem before.
Okay, and how did Travel Sentry's system, with their MOU with the TSA, operate within this context?
So Travel Sentry administered a competing system of dual-access locks. They entered into that MOU with the TSA, where Travel Sentry agreed to supply the TSA with these universal master keys that could open any lock certified by Travel Sentry.
Universal keys for their system.
Exactly. They also provided training to TSA personnel on how to use these keys and certified luggage locks manufactured by various companies as compatible with their system. So a traveler could purchase a Travel Sentry certified lock, and the TSA would have the master key to open it for inspection if necessary.
Now, this is the critical point that sets up the legal question of divided infringement. Who was actually performing the physical act of identifying a Travel Sentry lock and then using the master key to open it?
That was the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. Airline passengers would lock their bags with their Travel Sentry certified locks. Then, if a bag needed inspection, TSA personnel would be the ones to identify it as a Travel Sentry lock and use the master key provided by Travel Sentry to open the bag, conduct the inspection, and then relock it.
So Travel Sentry itself wasn't physically performing those unlocking and relocking steps?
No, they weren't. The TSA agents were.
Right. So the district court initially sided with Travel Sentry, finding that they were not infringing TROP's patents. What was a district court's reasoning, and where did the Federal Circuit, the appellate court for patent cases, say they got it wrong?
Well, the Federal Circuit found that the district court made a crucial error in how it defined the scope of the relevant activity. The district court essentially looked at the TSA's general activity of screening luggage, just screening bags.
Okay, too broad.
Yeah, the Federal Circuit argued that this was too broad and that the focus should have been specifically on the screening of luggage using the Travel Sentry system of locks and master keys.
Right.
That specific interaction.
That makes a huge difference in the analysis, doesn't it? By looking at the broader activity of luggage screening, the district court kind of missed the specific connection between Travel Sentry system and the steps outlined in TROP's patents.
Exactly. The Federal Circuit reasoned that once you correctly define the relevant activity as the screening of luggage using Travel Sentry locks and master keys, the roles of Travel Sentry and the TSA become, well, inextricably linked. They are both essential components of that specific process.
And the Federal Circuit also took issue with the district court's apparent downplaying of the significance of that MOU between Travel Sentry and the TSA, correct?
Absolutely. The Federal Circuit felt that the district court didn't give sufficient weight to how the MOU essentially created a system where the TSA's ability to efficiently screen luggage without damaging locks, a clear benefit to the TSA, right?
Definitely a benefit.
That benefit was directly contingent on the TSA performing the specific steps of using Travel Sentry's master keys on Travel Sentry certified locks, which happened to align with TROP's patented method.
Okay, so the Federal Circuit had a very different perspective on the facts. Walk us through their analysis, particularly focusing on how they applied that first prong of the Akamai test, the direction or control aspect.
Sure. The Federal Circuit's analysis centered on the idea that Travel Sentry conditioned the TSA's participation in their lock system and the benefits that came with it on the TSA performing the final steps of TROP's patented method, namely opening and then relocking those specific travel sentry locks using the provided master keys.
Conditioned to participation.
Yes. They emphasized that the MOU wasn't just some casual agreement. It implied clear exchange. Travel Sentry provides the system and the benefit of non-destructive opening, and in return, the TSA must use that system in the prescribed way if they want that benefit.
So the convenience and efficiency for the TSA were directly tied to them using Travel Sentry's system, which in turn involved performing steps covered by TROP's patents. It wasn't just optional.
Precisely. Furthermore, the Federal Circuit also concluded that Travel Sentry dictated the manner in which the TSA performed these steps. This wasn't simply a case of Travel Sentry providing a generic tool like a wrench.
Great.
They provided a very specific system with specific components, the certified locks, and the corresponding master keys that were designed to be used in a particular way. The MOU itself outlined the framework for this cooperation. Travel Sentry designed the unique interface between the locks and master keys, and they even provided training to TSA personnel on the correct procedures for using the system.
So it wasn't just about handing over the keys. Travel Sentry essentially defined the entire operational procedure for how their locks would be integrated into the TSA's screening process. Mm. They were telling them how to do it.
Exactly. The court stressed that Travel Sentry was not just a passive supplier. They actively established and maintained a system where the TSA was practically required to use TROP's patented method when dealing with Travel Sentry certified locks to realize the benefits of the MOU.
Makes sense.
The Federal Circuit also briefly mentioned the joint enterprise prong of Akamai as a potential alternative argument, suggesting that maybe the shared goal of efficient and secure luggage screening could potentially link Travel Sentry and the TSA in a joint enterprise. However, the core of their reasoning and the basis for their decision to overturn the lower court's ruling was clearly focused on the direction or control prong.
Okay. And what was the ultimate outcome of this analysis by the Federal Circuit? What did they actually decide? Did Travel Sentry infringe?
Ah, well, the key outcome was that the Federal Circuit vacated the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Travel Sentry.
Vacated. Okay, so what does that mean exactly?
This is a crucial legal point.
Yeah.
It means they didn't definitively rule that Travel Sentry did infringe TROP's patents. Not yet. Instead, they found that the district court had made errors in its legal reasoning and that there were genuine issues of material fact that needed to be decided by a jury at a full trial.
So, back to the drawing board, sort of.
Exactly. As the Federal Circuit stated in their majority opinion, and this is a key quote, a reasonable jury could conclude Travel Sentry conditions TSA's participation on performance of these steps. So they sent the case back down to the lower court for further proceedings, likely a trial.
Okay, so what are the most important takeaways for us from this case, and what broader implications does it have for the world of patent law, especially for, you know, law students listening?
Well, I think this case offers a really nuanced and important understanding of the concept of direct patent infringement, especially in situations involving multiple actors. It demonstrates that patent infringement liability can indeed exist even when a third party is the one physically performing the steps of a patented method.
As long as the alleged infringer exerts sufficient control.
Exactly. Provided that the alleged infringer exerts sufficient contractual or functional control over that third party's actions.
So it's not simply a matter of who physically does what. It's really about who has the leverage to dictate how those actions are performed and who benefits from the overall patented process.
Precisely. And a critical factor here is the ability to demonstrate the alleged infringer's leverage over the third party's actions. In Travel Sentry, that leverage stemmed from the MOU and the practical advantages it offered the TSA for utilizing Travel Sentry's system.
And this isn't just about locks, right?
Oh, definitely not. This has significant implications for a wide array of industries. Consider technology platforms where user actions might complete a patented process run by the platform provider, or, say, logistics networks that rely on independent carriers to execute patented delivery methods. Lots of areas.
It really highlights the critical role that contracts and agreements play in defining the relationships and responsibilities of different parties, and how those definitions can ultimately determine patent infringement liability. The paperwork matters.
Absolutely. And for our listeners who are law students, Travel Sentry v. TROP serves as a prime example of how seemingly straightforward legal concepts in patent law can become quite intricate in practice. It underscores the necessity of thoroughly analyzing the relationships and agreements between all involved entities when evaluating potential patent infringement.
So you can't just look at the surface level.
Right. It's not enough to just look at who is physically carrying out each step. you must delve into the underlying control mechanisms and conditions outlined in things like MOUs or other agreements.
And it's also important to remember, as the Federal Circuit pointed out, that this particular decision focused solely on the issue of infringement. It did not make a final determination on whether Tropp's patents were actually valid in the first place, right?
That's a crucial point to keep in mind, particularly under Section 101 of the Patent Act, which deals with patent-eligible subject matter. So there's potentially another whole layer of complexity regarding the patentability of Tropp's invention itself that wasn't resolved in this decision.
Just because you infringe doesn't mean the patent is valid.
Exactly. The fact that the infringement question even reached the Federal Circuit and hinged on these complex issues of divided infringement, though, underscores the ongoing evolution and nuances within patent law, even as they relate to fundamental questions of what can even be patented.
So to recap the key insight from our deep dive into Travel Century v. Tropp, this case powerfully illustrates how the Akamai framework allows for finding direct patent infringement even when one entity, like Travel Century, exerts direction or control over another party, such as the TSA, that performs the remaining steps of a patented method.
And the crucial elements are the conditioning of participation or benefits on performing those steps, and the dictation of the manner in which that performance occurs, that control piece.
Right, that control.
What's truly thought-provoking about this case, I think, is how it challenges our traditional understanding of direct infringement and forces us to adapt to the realities of modern innovation, where collaboration and distributed processes are increasingly the norm.
Okay, and on that note, here's a final thought for you, our listeners, to consider. In our increasingly interconnected world, where innovation so often involves the collaborative efforts of multiple parties, how will the principles established in Travel Century v. Tropp continue to shape the landscape of patent infringement litigation and the strategic decisions that companies make?
Yeah, think about the implications for how companies draft their contracts and structure their business relationships.
Both to potentially mitigate their own risks of infringing others' patents and, you know, to effectively protect their own patented inventions in these multi-actor scenarios.
It's certainly a complex and evolving area of law, and one that anyone dealing with patents needs to keep a close eye on.